Welcome to Dialogue, a program that explores the world of ideas and issues in national and international affairs, history, and culture. I'm George Liston, CA. The millennium that approaches us in such a welter of confusion, anxiety, and giddy celebration is not, of course, the first that humanity has faced. When Europe drew near to the first millennial anniversary, the world and what we would come to call Western civilization were in a far different state. It was an age of immense passion and violent confrontation as human will and religious ideals clashed, and in their collision defined the face of a continent and the course of a civilization. We do well to recall the era, both to appreciate important history and to better understand the currents that still swirl in the world as another millennium looms before us. My guest is James Reston, Jr., author of The Last Apocalypse, recently published by Doubleday. Jim, welcome to Dialogue.
Thank you, George.
It's a fine book. I'd recommend this to everybody. I think it's almost required reading as we come up on this magic date. One of the first things you do in the book, Jim, is you remind us, it's kind of a central theme that, of course, goes through succeeding chapters, that it was really the great sweep of Christianity that was the defining phenomena of the period of that 1000 AD. And I think to really get an appreciation of what that meant in that time and subsequently, I should ask you first about the background, the mood of Europe just prior to the millennium. What kinds of thoughts were going through people's heads as that date approached?
Well, I think this is a theme, the basic thrust of this book that kind of emerged for me out of trying to think about how to do this book in the first place. As you open the book now in its finished product, you see these maps. And I decided at the very beginning that what I wanted to do was to think of the millennium not as the turn of a day or even a year, but of a slow turning as would befit a thousand-year millennial hinge. So that this is a book that really begins about 950 AD and carries on afterwards for 15 or 20 years. And if you look at those maps as you open The Last Apocalypse, you'll see that the world of Christianity was very small in Europe at the year 950. It really was confined in France and part of Italy and then Byzantium, of course. But the rest of Europe, really most of Europe, had their own religions, had their own gods, their own totems. The Scandinavian territory was completely in the grip of the Norse gods, mm-hmm. this wonderful theology of Thor and Odin and
right.
Valhalla and Valkyries and all of these wonderful concepts. And Hungary had a very different set of gods and different mythology all together. Spain, of course, it's not pagan or infidel in any sense at all, but really the reverse is completely really in the grip of Islam.
Right.
And it is really the high culture of Europe mm-hmm. at the year 1000 and in the decades before.
Right.
So what happens in the course of the 60 or 70 years from 950 until 1020 is that essentially most or all of Europe Christianizes. Now, does it Christianize in the sense that we could take a vote or a poll and have, 95% of the populace saying they espoused Christianity? No. But what you do see is that the important personages, the kings and princes, almost all at once seem to convert to Christianity. And this is really a very, very important thing that happened.
I'm glad you mentioned that, because we will certainly turn to that. This is a book of rich character and rich characters.
Yes.
Indeed. I've got some personal favorites among the Moors, the Magyars, the Hungarians you depict here. Let's start with the first one. Oleg Trygvasson, do I pronounce this correctly?
Yes, you do.
And let me ask you this question about him as a way of framing your answer. A magnetic, charismatic person, a giant physically, a man of strong passions and quite frankly, considerable brutality, as many of the people we'll talk about were. As you describe him for us, Jim, this in particular interests me. His conception of Christianity is a very personal one. It was a very unique one. It seemed to me that there was an emphasis on, for example, the Book of Revelations in his case or among the people among his people, and that it had something to do with their own tradition of Ragnarok, and they saw a kind of a similarity in that which made Christianity. So I guess the question is, were these very personalized conceptions of Christianity that we're talking about here, very, very culture-oriented, so to speak?
Well, let me preface my answer, George, by saying that this was one of the questions that I put to myself at the outset of this, as to whether I really could personalize this history, whether I could tell it through a series of interlocking personalities. I was pretty sure as I got into my research here at the Wilson Center that I could do the Scandinavian material that way pretty well, because I had the Norse sagas to work with, which are very personal. But could it be extended to Hungary and to Spain and to Italy and Byzantium? I wasn't really sure about that. And if I could find my characters, how would I then make it consistent stylistically with what I had done first, which was the block on the Vikings and the Scandinavians? Yes, it starts with Olaf Trygvasson, who is a giant, as you say, and a brutal giant, and an evangelical Christian. Very dangerous mix altogether.
Particularly when you've got swords.
Yes, right. Who goes back on an evangelical mission from being in exile from Norway to conquer the land from a pagan king who has also been a nemesis to his own family in the past. And so he has a personal reason for revenge, which makes it all the more dangerous yet, again, if you've got a personal reason. And so he sets out to conquer Norway with the sword for Christianity and moves one province after another. There are a lot of brutal episodes that happen along the way, which are really quite wonderful in a bizarre sort of way. So he seemed like the right place to start, and it also gave me a kind of a full circle to start with him, because then as I would go from Norway to a different character, Sigrid the Haughty in Sweden and Svein Forkbeard in Denmark, I could come back to Olaf Trygvasson at the end, because they all become intertwined at the end in the way that I've chosen to tell it.
But you know, these notions, and Olaf is a very good example of this, these notions of Christianity, that they were literally carrying at the point of a spear or on the edge of a sword, and correct me, Jim, if I got this wrong, it wasn't so much a question of orthodoxy as their kind of individual evangelical vision, if you will, of the thing. Is that right? I mean, we're not dealing with theology here so much as in a sort of literate, profound sense as a kind of spirit feeling that they espoused.
Absolutely, that's the case, George. And it interests me a great deal, not only in the research, but when I would go to places like Iceland and Norway and Sweden, how on earth Christ per se could have won the day over these wonderful Norse gods that are already well established in an existence for many, many generations and centuries, because the Norse gods seem to be so perfectly suited to the Nordic sensibility. Mm-hmm. And what I was able to discover as I went along was that that figure that we know from the Catholic iconography, particularly from later on in the Middle Ages, or not in the Middle Ages, but in the Renaissance particularly, of that limp, tortured figure on the cross, bleeding figure, was not at all the Christ that was presented to the Scandinavians. Instead, it was Christ the Mighty King who was conquering all of Europe. And I include in the pictures of the book one of the icons of that mighty Christ figure. So it's a very masculine, a very mm-hmm. sort of broad-shouldered Christ that comes up against the broad shoulders of Odin and Thor.
To use a phrase of our own time, muscular Christianity at its most steroid,
perhaps. Yes, yes.
Jim, I want to turn to Moors and Magyars in a moment, but just before that, let me take a moment from our conversation to say that this is Dialogue, a presentation of PRI, Public Radio International. I'm George Liston C.A., and my guest today is James Reston Jr., author of The Last Apocalypse, published by Doubleday. Moors. Moors in Spain. That's a romantic sound to that, isn't there? I mean, history has really embellished that with...
I didn't have half a notion of how really? Romantic they could be.
I want you to give it to us, because here's something from those chapters, or that chapter, that I found deeply impressive to me. Now, as you pointed out, the Moors, of course, are adherents of Islam. So they don't. This comes as a powerful religion in its own right, a venerable religious tradition, to conquer Spain. But in that conquest, Jim, and here I hope I did get this absolutely correct in my mind, it seems that they made Cordoba the world's second great city, Baghdad being the first. This alone suggests to me the immensity and the power of the civilization and the religious emphasis they brought to Spain. Is that right?
Yes. Well, there were so many fundamental questions that I had to put to myself at the beginning of this book, George, and one of them was that you just had to wipe the slate clean of all your standard notions about what Europe is and was. London and Paris meant nothing, really. Berlin, these cities that we think of as the great places of Europe virtually didn't exist. Rome had been over a million citizens at the height of the Roman Empire. It had shrunk down to 100,000 and was a city of ruins, basically, at the year 1000. So it was a backwater town. As you say, the great city of the world was Baghdad. Here we've been talking about the Viking Empire and how they could go virtually all over Europe. Well, there is no Viking town that's more than about 1,000 people. So it's a set of villagers that have created an empire. Baghdad is a city of more than a million. And it is a great center of learning. But there is a split in the caliphate in Baghdad. And one branch of it flees from Baghdad through the Mediterranean, ends up in Spain, and that's how the caliphate gets established in Cordoba, and also how the knowledge of Baghdad, including the astronomy and the mathematics, comes from Baghdad and enters into Europe.
And exquisite architecture too, right?
Exquisite architecture, great poetry, great libraries. You know, there are virtually no libraries anywhere else in Europe but in Spain at this time. So that knowledge comes from Baghdad through the Mediterranean into Spain and then north over the Pyrenees. There's a whole system of monasteries devoted simply to translating mm-hmm. Arabic culture and Arabic knowledge into the European languages. Mm-hmm. And this was, well, I mean, all of it was new for mm-hmm. me, George, but this was a real insight into how knowledge travels. Cordoba is a fabulous place at this time. And Cordoba is destroyed at this time also, at the end of virtually mm-hmm. at that time of the millennium turn.
You know, Jim, each of these is a marvelous tale in and of itself. And when you see the linkages between them in terms of what was happening in Europe overall as a result of them, it's absolutely astounding. I must confess to you, that in the way that every reader picks his or her favorite chapter or story from the book, mine would probably be the Hungarians, because it was such an extraordinary revelation to me that if I here you have a people of mystical origins, one almost might say, you know, from where did they come with this language unlike any other, these traditions, and with this sense of themselves as marauders, as devotees of the white stag, I believe, of predators, with a strong use of the hawk as a symbol in all their rites. And then, in a practical sense, just as the Vikings with their ships, we have the Hungarians with their cavalry, 40,000 strong, sweeping across Europe. But at this point, prior to their conversion to Christianity, as a pagan marauding force, is that right?
That's absolutely so, mm-hmm. Yes. And I think it's the nomadic background of the Hungarian people that they're always unsettled. You know, this place can't be home. They have to move on to the next. And that makes for a very dangerous mix whenever you have it, I think. But as you say, this is a people with very mysterious origins. Some say they came from Siberia. They get intermixed with peoples as they come along over the centuries. Yes, and they pick up this extraordinary pagan religion that suits very, very well to their nomadic qualities. And, you know, they are absolutely the scourge of Central Europe right up into the 10th century. And then comes a climactic battle in 955
in Lechfeld, where they're
actually repulsed. Mm-hmm. And then gradually from that point forward, they start to recede back into the Carpathian Plain. But it is this one figure of Stephen the First who sees the value of becoming part of the wider Europe,
right.
The wider scheme of things mm-hmm. that has developed just at the year 1000, partly again because of the personal power and magnetism of this magnificent Pope, mm-hmm. but also because previously pagan lands see this as a way to dignify their own enterprise.
That's an excellent answer, as all yours have been, but particularly this one, because we're going to talk about the papacy in just a moment and the powerful figure of a very special pope. I guess into the popular mind, certainly my mind, prior to reading this book, the Holy Roman Empire was something to conjure with, and I always thought of, you know, it certainly was a great defining moment historically. But what does it mean to our story, Jim? What does it mean to the Christianization of Europe? Exactly what importance did it have?
This is a dynasty called the Ottonian dynasty that really begins in Germany, not in Rome, around 960, with a figure, Otto the First, who is really caught up in the old lore of Charlemagne and wants to take Charlemagne's notion that you could have an empire throughout Europe that was a perfect marriage of religion and empire, of the papacy and of the strong state. And Charlemagne did, in fact, invade down into Italy and came as far as Rome and then turned right around on his heel and left. And that was the end of that. But Otto the Great, the first of these Otto kings, had this notion of coming from Germany, from Central mm-hmm. Europe, and going to Rome and reestablishing that, quote, Holy Roman
right.
Empire. But the critical figure here is his grandson, Otto the Third, who comes to power in about 996. And he's a very young man and a very visionary person. He was one of the few who had a vibrant sense of the millennium and was full of apocalyptic forebodings. Mm. So he's the one figure that I really have that generally speaking, has, you know, been multiplied in our modern age here. And you know, if I've had to try to disabuse people of this notion once, I've had to do it 100 times recently here, that this was not a common sentiment, but was confined to just a few visionaries and mystics mm-hmm. like Otto III.
Now, these Ottonian kings, from Otto I to Otto III, had a variety of popes to deal with, didn't
yes.
they? And dare we say popes of unequal value.
Yes.
In fact,
ne'er-do-wells and thieves and terrible people altogether mm-hmm. up until Otto III.
And at the point that Otto III is the king, the pope is Sylvester II, is this correct?
Yes.
And this is a man of parts.
This is a truly extraordinary individual. I mean, of just as a man of 1000 AD, this is the most extraordinary man in this book and in this age. He is the first French pope. He is a teacher and an inventor. He's a musician. He has been educated, they think, in Spain, and therefore he may be infected in some way or another by Islam and the magical and mysterious arts of Islam. This will come to haunt him somewhat when he becomes pope. But he also becomes a diplomat, and he is an advisor to emperors and queens and kings. And in 998, he's made pope, forges this fascinating relationship with this young mystic leader, Otto III. And because I've written about astronomy in the past, I'm always drawn to images from astronomy. Here comes this pope who takes over in 998, this young leader who at the age of 22 or something takes over in 996, and together for 4 or 6 years here, they have this truly millennial vision of this important moment in time. And they have grand and grandiose schemes about how they're going to return Rome to its former grandeur, and how they are really going to keep in place a true Holy Roman Empire for all of Europe. But like a supernova in space, you know, this vision burns very brightly for those 6 years, and then both of them die in 1002, and that's the end of that.
Another powerful tale and a very affecting image of the supernova. Well, Jim Reston, to conclude a conversation that I have enjoyed almost as much as I enjoyed the book, which I enjoyed immensely indeed, let me ask you this question, which is that we have these notions of time, perhaps trivial notions, and then expectations that may be absurd as to what's going to happen, what kind of apocalyptic or grand moment a millennium is going to promise. And maybe you're telling us, and I guess this is the question, that maybe that's not what we're about. Maybe we're ultimately part of something that's far vaster than that, and that change is...
I call this book The Last Apocalypse, and somewhere along the way I looked into the meaning of apocalypse. And I've come to the belief that the word has become perverted from its original meaning. Its original meaning in its Greek origin is a revelation, is a disclosure, an unveiling. Has nothing to do in its root meaning with destruction, disaster, catastrophe. I believe that meaning was really came into existence probably around 1500, and we've carried it on ever since, this association with disaster. But if you think of apocalypse as an unveiling, the unveiling that you had at the year 1000 was the unveiling of a Christian world in Europe. You also had, instead of disaster and wholesale violence, you had a diminution of violence. There, the Vikings basically settled down. The Hungarians settled into their plain. The Moorish Caliphate regrettably, collapses, but by its collapse it means that it no longer torments Christians to the north. So really, I mean, in millennial terms, almost overnight, I want to say, by which I mean over a period of 20 or 30 years, you suddenly had a continent that was much safer, you know, and that was bound together and interconnected in some sort of way. Well, I think we have some modern parallels to that for the year 2000. We've had the collapse of the Soviet Union. We've had the end of the Cold War. We, to the extent that one is Christian, I mean, you have had the re-Christianization of formerly pagan areas. And so that if we took them, today's maps, and put them next to the maps of 1000 AD, we would see a similar kind of remaking of the whole face of the continent. We have also had the denuclearization of the superpowers. I've lived all my adult life in terror of nuclear disaster between the United States and Russia. To be sure, we've got this India-Pakistan thing now. But I think generally speaking, even with that, this is a lot safer world today than it was 20 years ago. So that's another connection. But to me, the ultimate apocalypse of the year 2000 is in outer space, is in the astronomy, that the kind of this revolution of astrophysics that we have in front of, where our cosmos has been unveiled to us in a way that, you know, almost every week or every month we see some new phenomenon in space that 30 or 40 years ago we could not have imagined. So if you think of our apocalypse in those ways, it can be a very, I think, quite positive concept.
That was a wonderful answer, Jim. I thank you for it. I thank you for the book, The Last Apocalypse, by James Reston, Jr., published by Doubleday. I hope to have you back on Dialogue again soon.
Thank you, George.
You have been listening to Dialogue. My guest today was James Reston, Jr., author of The Last Apocalypse, recently published by Doubleday. I'm George Liston C.A., producer and host of Dialogue. Our associate producer is Karen Reed, our technical director is John Tyler, and our production assistant is Kimberly Palmer. Dialogue is presented by PRI, Public Radio International, and is a production of the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars in association with Smithsonian Productions. Established by Congress in 1968, the center is our nation's official and living memorial to the 28th President of the United States, Woodrow Wilson.
For cassettes or more information on Dialogue, call us at 303-823-8000. Contact us on America Online at Radio Dial. That's RADIODIAL at AOL.com. Visit our internet webpage at wwics.si.edu.